We were coming down 17. And Bob said, you know, the rankings are out next week. And I said, I know. I mean, I've been following the score panel all my life. And I knew they were coming. And he said, do you want to know where he placed? And I said, Bob, just tell me where it is. And he said, it's second. And I remember feeling like I had the wind knocked out of me. And I bent over and put my hands on my knees. And I swore quite audibly. And Bob looked at me like I was from outer space. And I said, I didn't do it to be number second or number two, Bob. And he looked at me literally like he thought I might have been joking. I was not joking. I was so, you know, just so dismayed.
Welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne. Thanks so much for joining us. We are very excited to welcome Ben Cowan-Dewar to the podcast today, the co-founder and CEO of Cabot, a name you've heard a lot of lately if you follow golf course development or if you're a golf traveler looking to plan your next trip. Now, Ben and his team have taken the destination golf world by storm with properties in Canada, the U.S., Scotland, and the Caribbean. Cabot Cape Breton has been drawing golfers to Nova Scotia for a while now, but this has been a huge year for Cabot with new openings like Cabot St. Lucia, which debuted on top 100 lists before it even opened, and Cabot Citrus Farms in Florida, which the Broken Tea Society has already visited and will visit again later this year, and it has received nothing but rave reviews. Cabot is not slowing down anytime soon, and Ben was kind enough to join us to talk about how he went from being an obsessed golfer running a travel business to becoming one of the most successful golf developers in the world. He gives us his keys to success and talks about the ups and downs of building a brand. Ben's inspiring and relentless in the best way. And this conversation reminds us all that when the moment presents itself, we need to take our shot. It's also a story about a golf dream. And the Golfers Journal is excited to announce another golf dream story that intersects with Ben and Cabot in a very meaningful way. Now live on our YouTube channel, The Long Way Home is the latest film from the Golfers Journal, and it chronicles the struggle, tragedy, and the triumph of the former Worldwoods golf courses in Florida. Now, Worldwoods, it was once one of the most celebrated public golf facilities in America, but as it lost its funding, it fell into the hands of a general manager who refused to let it go, somehow keeping the lights on and holding out hope that the vision for the resort might someday be realized. Now, I won't spoil the ending for you, but it might have something to do with our guest today. Be sure to check it out. Be sure to check out the film on our YouTube channel. Now, no matter where you find yourself playing, whether it be a Cabot property or anywhere in golf, the goal is always to outperform the player you were yesterday. And that means playing a golf ball we know will help us get the most out of our game. The Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X offer advanced technology and performance that rewards your best swings and helps you shoot lower scores. The Pro V1, of course, is the best combination of distance, spin, and feel, and delivers a penetrating flight, while the Pro V1X flies higher and spins more in the short game, while still giving you low spin on longer shots to maximize your distance. So find out more about the Pro V1 and Pro V1X, including which is the best choice for you, at Titleist.com. Thanks for listening, everyone, and thanks for your continued support of the Golfers Journal. Now, quiet, please. Next up on the Golfers Journal podcast, Ben Cowan-Dewar. Ben Cowan-Dewar, CEO, co-founder of Cabot, now the growing Cabot, Cabot golf brand around the world, Scotland, Canada, America, the Caribbean, and really appreciate your time. So Ben, tell me your golf story. How did you get into golf and how did it become a part of your life?
I had a dad who was a golfer and a grandfather who was a golfer. And I think my sort of first golf memory was really Jack winning in 86 at Augusta. And I remember, you know, the fabric of our couch and watching it with my dad and just how meaningful it was to him. And, you know, I was, I guess I was about to turn seven. So that's sort of one of those early, early childhood memories. And, you know, and I think, I got a cut down golf club and I used to bang it around our yard. I grew up on a family farm east of Toronto. And then I started watching golf religiously and drawing golf holes and playing golf, and eventually would build a golf hole on our family farm. I built a green, and I couldn't figure out, I think I was probably 12. I couldn't really figure out the revetted bunker, but I'd seen the photos. So I dug the bunker and stacked it all up. So it was really hard. And then I had a series of seven tees, and I would mow it all myself, and I would go out and play golf after school. And then I was just, you know, hooked and really on courses. I had a copy of the World Atlas of Golf, and, you know, I would draw golf holes. My mom saved these drawings, and, you know, I would draw the clubhouses and the locker rooms. And, so not only was I hooked, I was a nerd, and it's been a part of my life ever since.
So how do we get to where we are today? So it sounds like, you know, at a young age, you feel it seems like as if you're destined to do this. But as a course developer, I mean, your path, you know, from what I know of your path, it wasn't sort of an obvious one where you went out and, well, you made your fortune and now I'm going to go look for some good land or something like that. How did Cabot come to be?
Well, so I, you know, again, I wanted to travel to play courses, and, you know, maybe I'll take you back for a second to my golf hole, because it's probably indicative of just being smaller when I was younger and not much different. But I was playing golf on my little hole, and my mom got a call asking for Mr. Cowan Dewar. And my mom's name was Sandra Cowan. My dad's name was Peter Dewar. And so she said, you know, Peter, and they said, no, Ben. And I was 13 at the time, and they were calling her to tell her that they were opening up phase three of real estate at a course north of Myrtle Beach, just in North Carolina, and that I'd, you know, subscribe for information. And so I was forever writing places to get packages and to plan golf trips for my dad and I. And so we would go on these golf trips, and I'd go and I'd see my grandfather in Florida and try and play as much golf as I could. And so I was just hooked on golf and planning trips. And, you know, at the beginning of the internet, I was at University of Toronto, and, you know, I sort of thought, I love golf, I love travel, and there was literally no one on the internet, and me and like two other people. And so I sort of set out to do this thing in golf travel. And really that, while I was a university student, morphed into a business that we were working in 20 plus countries. And because there just were so few people on the internet, and it was such early days, and travel, it's sort of easy to forget 25 years later, but travel was really one of the things that got disrupted the most and quickly. And if you were a golf resort in Europe trying to connect with you in Philadelphia, it really was hopefully through a tour operator, or maybe by sending you, you know, an enormous envelope with a brochure. And I think that, you know, really I was traveling all over and saying, like, look, we can get digital photos on the internet and we can connect you with a new. And so we ended up doing golf travel, but we ended up doing a lot of golf marketing and digital marketing and really learned how to build databases. And so, you know, but my favorite was there was one guy who said, this is all a bit of a scam, isn't it? And I was taken aback. I think I was in Ireland. And he said, you know, this is just so you can travel the world and play golf. And I said, it pretty much is. Like, that was pretty much what the business, you know, I didn't, as a university student, I had very little money. But we ended up doing, you know, a really good job of the marketing. And I think we came up with really innovative tours, and whether it was, you know, trying to play Pebble after the 2010 Open, or, you know, just experiences that people would otherwise have had a tough time doing. And so that got me traveling the world. I got to play basically all of the world's great golf courses. I was on Golf Magazine's panel for, well, over 20 years, probably now, I guess. You know, having seen pretty much all of the, you know, the great golf that was built. And the natural next step for me at 24 was to imagine that I should then go and build my own golf course. And I think it was very simple. It was, you know, I wanted to build a golf course under a brand that I could, you know, do it. And we found a piece of land that had been talked about for golf since before I was born in Nova Scotia. And I went and saw it 20 years ago this year, having heard about it from a minister of tourism. And at, you know, 24 going on 25, I said, I think I can build one of the great courses in Canada. And if I can do that, it would be one of the great courses in the world. And I had my rose colored glasses on and set out to do it.
And so you have partners along the way. At what point does Mr. Kaiser come into the story?
So I saw the land in December of 04. And I called Mike in January of 05, and I'd been down at the opening of Barnboogle Dunes and Tom Doak's Renaissance Cup at Cape Kidnappers. And so I knew Mike a little bit, and we spoke in January of 05. And I said, I've got this great site in Cape Breton Island. Rod Whitman, who Bill Coor and Pete Dye had both said was the most talented architect no one had heard of. And, you know, Mike had heard of Rod. He knew him. They'd explored, of all things, doing a golf course in Cuba once upon a time. And so, you know, you sort of, the first pitch I had on Cabot was a banker. And he said, that is the worst idea, with an expletive in there, that I've ever heard. And I hear bad ideas for a living. And so, you know, almost everybody thought it was just a terrible idea, you know, 900 miles east of my home in a very small community. And people would say things like, can't you just do this near Toronto? Like, you know, why are you going to rural Cape Breton? And, you know, obviously, as you know, having seen so many of the Great Lakes sites, you know, to have a mile of ocean frontage in Canada was just, you know, there were two coasts you could do it. And the only land that looked anything like Lynx was this. So Mike was so gracious. He took the call and, you know, he basically said, look, I've bitten off more than I can chew in remote golf. Barnboogle had just opened. Wasn't clear that it would be the huge success that it has been. And Bandon Trails was opening that June. And he said, you know, I'm long remote golf. I'm not your guy. And I sort of called it the polite brush off. But he said, wait, Ben. And I said, yeah. And he said, you got to get more land. I said, Mike, I don't have enough money to build the first course. You know, I'm really long real estate in this community. Like, I'm not sure, you know, I can buy more land. And he said, well, you've got to, because, you know, you'll need it and you'll be successful. And when you're successful, you won't be able to buy it. And you need land for a second course. So he said, you know, go option it. And so, you know, I sort of thought of it as the polite brush off, but such a, you know, wise man, and had given me the advice. And so I started optioning the land that was Cabot Cliffs. And, you know, the community, Cabot Links was 13 parcels of land, and it was a mix of, you know, government, provincial and municipal, volunteer groups and private landholders. And while Nicholas had done a routing plan for it, and other, you know, Mike Herdson had said it was one of the 50 greatest sites left for golf in the world, no one had ever really been able to assemble the land. And, you know, I had time and a slide projector, and I would show photos of places like Sandhills and, you know, Ballybunion and Bandon Dunes, and say, I've been to these places and I can envision something like this in a rural community really being transformative. And there was a collection of folks in Inverness who had really fostered this dream. You know, the first conversation as far back as 1969 of building a golf course to reverse, you know, what had been a once booming coal mining town from 1883 to 1953. But had really seen significant decline and had seen its young people leave. And, you know, these folks, many of whom are dear friends to this day, you know, sort of tolerated a 25-year-old telling them, you know, I'm sure in hyperbolic language that, you know, I really felt like I could build this, having never done anything. And, you know, some of the questions would be, So you're a golf pro? And no, I'm not. You're a golf architect? No. Have you ever worked at a golf course? I haven't. You know, have you ever developed anything? No. And so eventually I'd say, like, listen, I haven't done any of this, just before we embarrassingly go through the list of things, but I could see it in Technicolor with my eyes closed. And, you know, I was investing basically every penny I had in this dream, and thankfully I was doing okay. You know, and I had a girlfriend who would become my wife, and two parents who all said they thought I could do it, which I think any rational person would have not said that. But so I blamed the three of them, and away we went. And so I assembled the land that was the first course. And as I was doing that, and it took us from that December 04 visit to November of 07 to really do all the land assembly, I realized that nobody would have taken the time to do it. It was just so, you know, so difficult and so hard. And part of it, you know, I have a book of Mike Kaiserisms, but, you know, one of them is, you know, Mike's line is, it's all a test. And so I circled back to him in November of 06, and we had a dinner in Chicago. And, you know, it was clear to me then that, you know, obviously trails have been a huge success, but in the intervening almost 2 years that had transpired, you know, lots of people said they were going to build a golf course. Lots of people might have had a dream, but, you know, that I put in the time and that it became clear I was going to be able to assemble the land, I think gave Mike sort of thoughts that, and this is, you know, I mean, first of all, an amazing man, but also someone who had taken long shots on young people, whether it was David McClay Kidd at Bandon Dunes, you know, or Josh Lesnick as opening GM, I think. And I think it's a bit of a strategy of throwing them in the deep end, and you get to hear about the ones that swam. But, you know, Mike was sort of engaged. He came in March of 07 with Bill Coor, and Rod Whitman toured them around links. We looked at the land that I'd optioned that is now Cabot Cliffs. And Mike had an entourage, and that night, as he's written in his recent book, we had a dinner, and Mike said, I'll do, you know, I'll do what is now Cliffs first, and we'll do the town course second. And I said, oh God, you know, I can't do that. I mean, I've been here for, you know, 2.5 years, and, you know, with my slideshow showing, you know, what we would do at Cabot Links, and this was really so integral to the town. And I remember what seemed like an eternity. I'm sure it was probably a handful of seconds, but, you know, there was just silence, and I could see everybody looking at me like Mike Kaiser was standing there ready to back me. And I was saying no. But, you know, I think again, in the Mike liking tests and caring deeply about integrity, I think that mattered to him. And he said, fine, we'll do it your way, and we'll do Cabot Links first. And so, that was March of 07. We got the land deal done in November. I moved from downtown Toronto to Inverness, Nova Scotia, with my wife, 35 weeks pregnant, to a house that was not yet complete. And it sort of seemed like all of the stars were falling into place. And then, of course, the Great Recession happened. But that's how Mike became involved. So November of 07, he officially said he'd back me, and we became partners.
So Mike Kaiser initially gives you the polite brush off. The folks in town are asking very good questions about the experience that you don't have. What is it about you, Ben, that, you know, that those kinds of responses are enough, or a banker telling you this is the worst idea I've ever heard? Those kinds of responses are enough to make a lot of people say, all right, I'll do something else. What is it about you that kept you going down this path?
Well, I probably couldn't get a job doing anything else, so that was probably one good thing that would keep steering me back. And, you know, I think entrepreneurs have deep amounts of fear and self-loathing, Tom. I think even really up until when they've, you know, done something, and I think it eventually goes away, but it takes a long time. And I certainly had it. And, you know, people would, you know, people were trying. I mean, people said terrible things. That is one thing that does happen to young entrepreneurs, is you endure a lot of people telling you it's, you know, really, really a terrible idea and that they know better. And I think, you know, those are tough things to overcome. And there were lots of sleepless nights and lots of trips, particularly before Mike agreed to partner, where I literally am, you know, using up every penny I've made at this young point in my life and what I thought had been a successful business. And I'm investing in a business that everybody's telling me, you know, won't be successful. And I would fly to Halifax from Toronto. And it seemed like every time I landed there, it was raining. And there, you know, I was always renting with, you know, budget rental car, which was at the farthest corner of the parking lot. And there's now a whole parkade. But I used to have to walk across this parking lot in the pouring rain to be drenched by the time I got in my car. And I'd start driving. But every single time I pulled onto Cape Breton Island, that the sun sort of came out and you sort of saw this land that was so breathtaking. And I'd see the people and I'd stand on the site and I'd smell the salt air. And I just had an enduring belief that it could be done. And that if it was, it would be really amazing. And, you know, I had that every single time I got to the site, and the entire journey each time I had lots of thoughts of, you know, this. And I honestly think if in those 2 years of, you know, sort of toiling along and not getting a lot of positive reinforcement, somebody had said they'd give me, you know, $100 and a pat on the head, or they'd take it forward and build it, I might have passed the baton. You know, I think I just wanted to see it done, and I wanted to see the town done right by it. And I think that probably kept me going.
We had a great dinner at the PGA show this year, and you talked a little bit about the initial reception from the town, and I would say, like, they didn't quite get it. How did you push through that? And then when the course comes out, right? I mean, the course opens, you know, you get your first ranking, and I thought that was a great story that revealed sort of, maybe this is one of your keys to success, your competitive nature.
Well, I think, you know, so I think the town got the promise of Lynx Golf. I think, you know, it had been a dream of theirs before it was a dream of mine. So I don't think it was so much that, you know, maybe the town fathers who had pushed this dream didn't get it. Many of them had been to St. Andrews, and sort of, so they knew it. So I think there was a cohort that absolutely believed in it. I think there was a very healthy degree of skepticism from the vast majority of the folks in town. And, you know, my first person, as I was pumping gas, I said, what do you think of this golf course idea? And he said, that'll never happen. and so there was certainly a lot of that. And again, we started building just before the financial crisis, and, you know, we almost didn't continue. And that winter of 08 and 09 was so terribly difficult. And, you know, Mike had called and said, I don't think we can move forward. And so, you know, we came up. And so I think people were naturally skeptical because every golf course in existence stopped. And I think, you know, Golf Digest in 09 said we were one of four golf courses in the world under construction. So it was slow going. It was difficult times. There are lots of reasons to be skeptical. But really, I think it's a, you know, it's a rural, and I grew up in rural Ontario, it's a rural protection of not wanting to get your hopes too high to have them dashed. And progress and change have not been kind to, you know, rural world in the last 50 years. You know, it's almost all been losing things as opposed to gaining them. But I think when we opened, you know, and that fellow who said, you know, it would never happen the day before we opened, as we had, you know, big event tent and we had opening day and people arriving, somebody said, what do you think now? And he said, it's not open yet. So, you know, I knew we'd have to convince our fair share of folks. But, you know, we were so lucky. Bill Pennington wrote a piece in the New York Times the weekend we opened, and it was the cover of the Sunday Sports, a 2-page inset. And, you know, there really, as you remember, in 2012, there was no golf opening. So I think that piece, which Bill wrote so beautifully, captured a lot of imagination and was a really new and neat story in golf. And, And that really, you know, launched us forward. And on opening weekend of Cabot Links, there's a great photo I have of Mike Kaiser, Bill Coor, and I walking around, you know, Cabot Cliffs. And on every opening, everybody says, like, what's next? And I'm always hoping I might just get to enjoy the day without having to think about what's next. But we actually were trudging around at Cliffs the day after we opened Links. And so, you know, that success came, you know, pretty quickly. And we moved ahead with Cliffs with Bill Coor and Ben Crenshaw. And the first ranking you're asking about, Bob Weeks, the great Canadian golf writer who had been the longtime editor of Score Golf and the head of the Score panel, was walking around Cabot Cliffs. I don't know if this is a good story to tell. Maybe it's a better one left untold. But we were coming down 17, and Bob said, you know, the rankings are out next week. And I said, I know. I mean, I've been following the Score panel all my life, and I knew they were coming. And he said, do you want to know where you placed? I said, of course I do, Bob. And he said, highest debut ever. I said, just tell me the number, Bob. And he said, first time a Canadian course has been in the top, you know, the top 10. I said, Bob, just tell me where it is. And he said, it's second. And I remember feeling like I had the wind knocked out of me, and I bent over and put my hands on my knees, and I swore quite audibly. And Bob looked at me like I was from outer space, like I was, you know, I'd been such a jerk and, you know, a young punk. And I said, I didn't do it to be number second or number two, Bob. And he looked at me literally like he thought I might have been joking. I was not joking. I was so, you know, just so dismayed. And anyway, so I think, you know, that's sort of, God, what would I have been, 32 maybe. So that's sort of a young and a young punk and naive, but it was, the goal was, you know, to be number one. And on that list, we've been one and two in Canada at some point since with both Cliffs and Links. So, you know, I think it's really setting out to do something extraordinary, and it was just so difficult. I mean, it really was, it's just so hard to, you know, pull these things off and to have them be successful. I think, you know, you sort of have to have an audacious goal or else it probably wasn't worth doing.
So competitiveness, setting high goals, what are your keys to success? I mean, either personally, things that you have to do or focus on, or organizationally, priorities that you've set?
Well, I have a poster on my wall right there that says work hard and be nice to people. And I think that, you know, that is seemingly simple, but I sort of think, you know, the entrepreneurial constructs of the great entrepreneurs are all pretty simple. Mike's were do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it and be someone people want to work with. Sounds very, very, very simple. Almost no one does both of those things. And, you know, another great entrepreneur's line of the right decision is terrific. The wrong decision can be fixed, but no decision kills you every time, I think is another one. I think that the doing what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it literally, you know, means showing up early for a meeting. It means being on time, right? I mean, it's like that's a very simple thing. If you say you're going to be there at noon, you get there a couple minutes early. And I think those things, you know, have paid enormous dividends. I've been so blessed to have such wonderful mentors. You know, and I think golf gave me that more than it gave me many, many, many gifts. But I think it gave me the ability to connect with these. I mean, if I'd been in widgets, I certainly wouldn't have gotten to meet, you know, Julian Robertson or Herb Kohler or, you know, Mike Kaiser. And golf gave me time with, you know, with them to know them and, you know, sort of learn lessons of life. And I think I was probably always a little bit older than my age. You know, so I've still got lots of friends in their 80s.
So who do you rely on and trust the most?
Well, I think if you're an entrepreneur, you sort of have to rely and trust yourself the most every single day. And I think, you know, it's a long journey to get to a place that you feel credentialized. And to be honest, when, you know, Cliffs opened and to even more fanfare than Lynx. I went and tried to talk myself into a job working for the greatest private equity guy in Toronto. And, you know, I put on a suit, and this is like, I mean, Cabot, this is probably 2016. So Cabot Cliffs is open. Cabot Lynx is open. It's successful. I did Cabot, and still at that point, people are telling me golf's a terrible business. You know, you gotta stay away. You gotta diversify away from golf. And I bought some industrial service businesses, and you know, I went and had lunch with this fellow who's one of my great friends, wonderful, wonderful, thoughtful partner. And, you know, you sort of serendipitously meet these people at the right points along the road. And I was pitching him on why he should hire me to come and work. And he's like, you know, you'd go crazy working at my place. He's like, don't you have a master's degree in golf? Like, can't you just go find something to do in golf? And, you know, he told me I was unhirable again, which I'd heard. So, you know, I went and focused on it, and that really sent me in the direction. It was actually in the fall of 15. It sent me in the direction of, okay, well, what can I do, you know, off of Cabot? And, you know, as much success as we were having in Nova Scotia, we weren't playing golf in January or February. And so I sort of had this notion of maybe I could go to the Caribbean, where, you know, part of my is as audacious as you would expect of a 25-year-old. My Cape Breton plan was to build two courses that were in the World Top 100 and would be two of the best in Canada. And so I sort of thought the Caribbean, which Teeth of the Dog, which I'd long admired, had been in the World Top 100, but there'd never been another course in the Caribbean. So I sort of thought, well, you know, I don't really like the winter. I live in Canada, and there's a lot of coastline in the Caribbean. So I started looking through all of the British Commonwealth islands, and in 2008, the financial crisis decimated the Caribbean, and there were many failed projects. And so, you know, I went and just looked through all of them. And in January of 16, I saw the land that was St. Lucia, and that became clear. And Mike Kaiser and his son Michael came back a month later, and we walked that land. But as soon as I stood on it, I knew I was going to do that. So I think I had to trust myself.
So that brings us to St. Lucia. It's just an extraordinary property. So congratulations on what's been achieved there. How gratifying was it to see it right out of the gate, see it ranked so highly?
Oh, I mean, look, it's amazing. And I don't take any of that for granted. I think, you know, seeing it ranked highly and on the cover of magazines, you know, before it was barely open for play, you know, those are things that still, you know, give me goosebumps. And I think, you know, Cliffs was such a rapid fire thing. I was in a rush, you know, I was trying to get it done. And St. Lucia, I said to myself, I was going to enjoy the process more, you know, because I know how quickly it goes by, it just flies by. And the dreaming, conceiving, and building are the most fun. The having conceived and getting awards is the least fun part of the process. So, you know, and I'd worked with Bill Coor and Ben Crenshaw at Cabot Cliffs. And so to get to work with them again, I mean, these are not two of the nicest men in golf course architecture. These are two of the great men you'd meet in your lifetime. And they happen to be partners. And so I said, like, I'm really going to be present and enjoy it. And, you know, we start construction and then COVID hits. And it's just like, you know, like Cape Breton all over again. I called Mike and he said, well, we've got the playbook for this. We just keep building it, you know, through. And again, it, you know, that seemed contrarian in Nova Scotia through the financial crisis, certainly seemed contrarian through COVID. But, you know, we just knew if we kept building it, you know, this too would eventually pass. And on the other side of it, people would be happy to have this thing, you know, open. And so, you know, we were so lucky to have Bill and Ben's crew decide to stay there and build through COVID. And this is a period of time where flights were canceled for months, right? So it wasn't clear, you know, they would get out of it. And I think, you know, they kept going, and this it slowed us down pace wise. And I actually think that probably was better for the golf course. And I remember, you know, calling Mike and saying, "Let's go down there." I hadn't seen him; we hadn't seen each other for probably the longest stretch in our time as partners. And he said, "Oh, I don't know." And I said, "Come on, it'll just be you, me, Bill, and Ben, and we'll walk around." And I've got a great photo on my wall of the four of us that day. And we just walked all 18 holes and just talked about golf and, you know, about life as you do, and about what they were building, and giving Bill and Ben 9 greens on the ocean in a place that's 83 degrees every day. You know, I sort of felt like it was cheating as a developer. So, you know, they damn well should have built something that was good with that site. And they obviously did.
They certainly did. I would say it's a unique, I mean, when you think of Core Crenshaw courses, I mean, St. Lucia stands out certainly for its boldness. You know, the property is absolutely, it's just, it could, I mean, dramatic doesn't quite capture it, right? How was that experience? Did you have to push them at all to kind of like get out of their comfort zone at all? Or it just seemed, it's a departure, but I think in a very exciting, dramatic, wonderful way.
Yeah, no, push them. You know, there's, you get their side of the story. I think drag them kicking and screaming probably a little bit. You know, Bill was very, very, very concerned they weren't the right architects for the job. And, you know, I was on a panel with Jack shortly after Bill and Ben agreed to do it. And Jack had done a routing plan in St. Lucia. And he said, you know, "I heard you're going to do St. Lucia." I said, "I feel so terrible because I idolized Jack, you know, back to your, what was my first memory. And I used to wake up and watch those Masters highlights on Thursday and Friday night on CBS. And I just loved Jack, loved the Masters." And I said, "You know, we're going to use Bill and Ben in St. Lucia." So that was my Pebble Beach site, you know, like I said, "Oh, I know." But, you know, it was, Jack had done a hell of a routing. And it wasn't that I didn't think super highly of him. It was that I just literally had so much fun working with Bill and Ben that I thought, you know, if they could figure it out. And it was a puzzle as it is, you know, and figuring out a routing that, you know, as spectacular as the photos are of that site, it's still, for me, and obviously I've been going there now for 8 years, it like hits me in the chest almost, you know, when I see it. It's like, holy moly. Or I'll see views and I'll turn, it's like I've seen them for the first time. And so I knew how jaw-dropping and awe-inspiring it was. And the real key was given the boldness and the elevation change. And now, you know, Bill and Ben have had obviously one of the most illustrious careers, but I'd always been a huge fan of Kapalua. And I think Kapalua was a tropical, heavily undulating. I mean, just think about those closing holes that we've watched on TV for so many years and how much elevation changed. So I felt like it wasn't like this. It was a dramatic departure from Friar's Head and Old Sandwich and maybe Cabot Cliffs. But, you know, I felt like it sort of harkened a bit back to Kapalua. Bill assured me it did not, but he eventually took pity on me again, and you know, and what a pleasure it is to have gotten to work with them again.
So a very unique site, and had some unique challenges too. You know, I remember being down there and hearing about it because there's unique weather patterns there, and the topography. There were, you know, getting the grass to stick. There were some real innovations there in getting the property ready, if I recall.
Oh, 1,000%. I mean, I think the, you know, we would seed everything, and then you'd have, you know, a 1 in 10 year rain event, and it would wash it all out. And, you know, the nice thing about experience is the same thing happened to Cabot Links and the same thing happened at Cabot Cliffs. And so, you know, you send folks those photos and you just say, "Listen, I know it's heartbreaking. I remember it so well. And, you know, we just got to get back out there and rebuild it. And, you know, we'll get there." And we did. And we just had, you know, an unbelievable crew of folks. You know, led by Jim Barger, who was the contractor, and Keith Reb, who stayed during COVID, and Trevor Dormer, who he and his wife Chelsea and their two children lived in St. Lucia for a couple of years. And, you know, those things, when you see the output and you see the success, these things are always a human story. And it is an enormous amount of sacrifice to, you know, to those individuals, to their families. And I think the creative process is beautiful, but you give up a lot of yourself in it, you know. And I think that the human cost of success is an awful lot of sacrifice. And I never take for granted what all of those folks did to make that a reality, and continue to do our team on the ground, you know, every day. It's, you know, and it's just a spectacular place. And St. Lucia's, you know, been a wonderful country to do business. And the people of St. Lucia, like the people of Cape Breton, you know, were so warm and hopeful for the future and wanted to see it succeed. And, you know, so I think the bumps in the road of development are always hard and, you know, can throw you off balance. But I think if you can see the finished product in your mind, it, you know, it's worthwhile to persevere.
Very worthwhile. And it's something, it's one of those places you have to sort of, you really kind of have to see it to believe it. It's hard to even sort of describe some of the views and some of the shots that you get to hit. So an extraordinary contribution to golf. Now, you're in a unique position of opening two golf courses relatively, you know, within months of each other. So Cabot St. Lucia, what made you take the chance on World Woods, which is now Cabot Citrus Farms?
Well, I had I'd gone to World Woods a long time ago, and you know, I'm a great believer in serendipity. But I got paired. They said we're going to pair you with a Canadian, and I got paired with a hockey player named Paul Henderson, who is an absolute legend in Canada because he had famously scored the winning goal against the Russians in the Summit Series in 1972, which predated me. But he's such an icon, I knew who he was. And so literally I'm at World Woods, and this is well over 20 years ago. And there I am playing with Paul Henderson, sort of, you know, and it was quite a memorable day. But really, I'd played golf all over Florida at that point, and it was so different, and it felt so different. And, you know, it felt like Georgia or the Carolinas, but it was obviously warmer in this January day I was there, and I just loved it. And I thought, I reached out, you know, again, as I did when I had no money and lots of ambition, and, you know, thought about buying it in, you know, 2008, '09, and, you know, tried in 2014 and 16. And in COVID, which was an existential crisis for us, you know, of Nova Scotia was closed. I didn't go there in 2020. You know, St. Lucia, there were no flights to the island for 6 months, but we had a thought that, you know, it would be like a financial crisis. It wasn't really actually like the financial crisis was devastating for golf. And, you know, Sea Island got sold in 2010 for $202 million. And I just remember thinking, gosh, there's going to be a chance to buy some great assets. And the two at the top of my list were World Woods and Castle Stewart. And, you know, in both cases, it created the on-ramp to have the conversation. And Mr. Inouye, who had conceived of World Woods, was now 90 years old in Japan. And he'd started, and again, Tom, you know it, but World Woods opened in 1993 with 36 holes, a par three, a circular driving range. And, you know, I remember Gil Hand saying it was the ninth wonder of the golfing world, the circular range. And Mr. Inouye had dreams of building more golf. He ran into savings and loan and challenges in Japan, but, you know, he sort of had this unique vision of 36 holes of public golf, and that's 6 years prior to Bandon Dunes opening. So it was a real revelation, but more than the quality of the golf, it was just the landscape was so beautiful. And so, you know, through 2020 and into 21, we started chatting on Zoom, and, you know, I'd come up with these innovative backgrounds of, you know, Cabot Cliffs and World Woods behind me, and he got a kick out of that. And he didn't speak a word of English, and I knew how to say hello in Japan, but we had a translator, and eventually he sort of, I think, saw me as the steward of his vision, which at that point was 35 years, started when he was 55 years old. And he recently passed away, but you know, it was just a wonderful process to buy it. And I felt, you know, honored to be able to take it on. And, you know, I think there are a few golf courses that, you know, most places have decided where the clubhouse is or where the hotel is, maybe they sold some homes along it. And so it's very hard to reimagine it. And I think Whirlwoods was unique in that, as was Castle Stewart. Gill and Mark Parson had built an unbelievable golf course, which I loved, and a great clubhouse. And they had permitting for a second golf course, which they hadn't built, and permitting for lodgings. But, you know, they sort of hadn't totally told their stories. And so there was enough to, you know, to reinvigorate both of those projects. And so we bought them 6 months apart. And obviously Castle Stewart, Tom Doak's building our second course there, and just doing an amazing job, you know, which will open in 25. And Whirlwoods was this thesis I had of, if you had existing golf and you could renovate it quickly, it would be a lot easier than buying 40 plus pieces of land in Nova Scotia and going through an arduous, you know, permitting process. And again, not that I'm getting smarter, but maybe just trying to avoid the ditches more. You know, in 2 years since we purchased Whirlwoods, we effectively had 36 holes, a 9-holer, and a par 3, which is more golf infrastructure than we have in Nova Scotia after almost 20 years. So, you know, it certainly was an amazing opportunity, and the reception has been phenomenal. But really, that was a testament to Mr. Inouye and his original vision, and we're just happy to be a steward of it going forward.
Well, it's very, very exciting. The Broken Tee Society, as you know, has already been there. Rave reviews. I had the chance to visit as well and do some preview play, and it is just an absolute blast. It's not the Florida golf you're used to. A special day. You know what they love the most, Ben? I mean, they love the golf holes, they love the golf course. Something very smart that you did, your placement of the halfway house. It was a very social experience there, and everyone came out feeling like they got to know each other from that day, because they kept crossing paths and stopping to talk about how much they're loving the course. And so it's just a very fun place to be. So kudos to you on making that happen.
Well, I think that's great. I mean, that's the nicest compliment, right? I mean, none of our customers do this for a living. You know, the pro golfers, get comped their green fees. So basically every single person who pays to play golf is doing it. We do it for fun. And so I think, you know, fun is what we're after, both in, you know, hopefully the experience and the vibe, but, you know, certainly the golf too. So I'll take that compliment.
Vibe, very strong vibe. Lots going on at Cabot as well. I mean, then you've got, of course, you mentioned the Highlands course the Highlands property, Castle Stewart, formerly, which is now is going to have a Doak course. You've got Revelstoke in British Columbia, which sounds fascinating. I mean, I guess that's more of a sort of family resort with, you're going to have four season amenities there.
Yeah, Revelstoke is the golf course is at the base of, you know, the greatest ski mountain, you know, probably in North America. I mean, it has 5,700 feet of vertical drop, which is, you know, almost twice most of the ones you'd think of, like Aspen and so on. And just an amazing mountain. And I've heli-skied there, you know, over the years, and I just absolutely love the town and love the mountain. And when I went to look at it, you know, I'd said to the patriarch who owned the land that there's no good golf in the mountains, because what's good for ski slopes is bad for golf courses. And, you know, Banff Springs and Jasper Park are really the exceptions in Alberta. But I went and looked at this land, which again, you know, Nick Faldo with Schmidt and Curley had done a routing plan, which had gone away in the financial crisis. And it was such a unique site, because the mountain is obviously, you know, rises fairly aggressively, and then it comes down into the Columbia River Valley, which then flows south to Oregon and has these beautiful views on the other side of the river valley. But the golf land was this benchland that sort of had, you know, 20-25 feet of elevation change, but was never really severe. It actually reminded me at points, you know, a bit of Brookline playing over, you know, these outcroppings. And I was on the site and I called Rod Whitman, who had grown up in Alberta and had done Cabot Links for me, obviously. And Banff and Jasper were such seminal works. And one of the things I always loved about Cabot Links was I gave Rod a chance to build a golf course in Cape Breton where Thompson had built Cape Breton Highlands Links, which is one of my favorite golf courses. And, you know, I love Banff and Jasper. And I sort of thought Rod would really jump at the opportunity of doing something in the mountains. And so while he'd grown up in Alberta, looking at those, he actually lives in British Columbia now. So I said, you know, can you get in the car and come over and have a look at it? And, you know, Rod Whitman is just, you know, one of the greatest golf architects and one of the gems of humanity too. So, to get to work with he and Dave Axelon and Keith Cutton on that project, is proving a lot of fun. And I think it's, you know, there aren't many places. We weren't looking at particularly to do something again in Canada, although I sit in Toronto talking to you today. But Revelstoke with an amazing winter already, you know, is just a breathtaking place to be in the summer. So it sort of seemed like, you know, a good chance and give Rod a canvas to, you know, put something up against, Stanley's mountain work. And yeah, we're excited about that.
Haven't been up to that part of the world yet, Ben, but that's absolutely going to happen now. Do I have to take a helicopter to ski the mountain?
No, not at all.
All right. I didn't know heli skiing was a thing, but.
Oh, it's a great thing. But, you know, the first tee is literally, you know, right beside the gondola that goes up. And again, you know, the runs are unbelievably long because, you know, just have 5,700 feet of drop. But, yeah, no, it's a great ski mountain. And, you know, the proximity to the first tee to the gondola is a dream. So
will the cups at Revelstoke ring like a morning chime? Tell us about the origin. Anyone that's played a Cabot property, or if you play, you know, at Cabot. So, yeah, I think, well, I didn't see it. It's St. Lucia. The holes weren't quite in yet. But tell us the origin of the unique nature of your cups.
They're in St. Lucia too now. But, okay. Yeah, so I'd gone to Japan, and I was playing with Sho Tobari, and Show it was sort of the Johnny Miller of Japan, and we were playing at Tokyo Golf Club, and there's no place in the world that golf is more foreign as an experience than Japan, really, truly, utterly onto itself. And so we tee off at Tokyo with our female caddies, and, you know, I hit it down the left side, didn't hit it very well, and I hit it thin up on the green, and I had like a 50-footer. And I knocked it in, and I heard ding, which I'd never heard before. And I thought it was just the most amazing thing. And I swore if ever I got to build my own golf course, I would do this. And it actually became sort of a bit of a running joke because it was so brutally hard because, you know, the Japanese were not exporting this. So we finally got a translator, and we bought them for Cabot Links, and I was so excited. People really liked this. And then my superintendent said, you know, the ferrules, the pins don't fit in them. So then we had to buy the ferrules from Japan and have them sent and cut them off and solder them. So, you know, it seemed like a lot of work. But, you know, there was a guy in the first year at Lynx who wrote a poem about the ding. Another person who put it on iTunes. And, you know, I've had friends who you hear the ding is sort of their notification. And people used to have those for text messages. So I like it. And I think, you know, it's sort of how do we continue the strands of what was special in the first days across the various properties as we now, as you said, expand into different geographies.
It's very fun. It's very cool. It's a nice little trademark that reminds people where they are.
Well, it's all over Japan, so it's not an original idea, but yeah.
Very cool. Ben, I can't thank you enough for the time. Before we let you go, I just think, you know, I so admire what you've, you know, what you've accomplished, what you've brought to golf, and having seen you interact with people in different circumstances, the way that you treat people as well. How do you define what success is for you, and do you feel like you've achieved it?
Well, I think, I think we had 712 people work in Cape Breton this past year. And if you think about all the outlandish dreams I would have had, you know, almost 20 years ago for that project, I never would have thought of that. And, you know, Mike always has the best quote, so I'll paraphrase him and say, it's not why we did it, but it's why we do it. And I think, other than my family, there's no one who's had a greater impact on my life than Mike. And, he would often tell me to slow down and, you know, the old course has been there for 500 years and Dornick's been there for 400 years. So what's the rush? But I was like, we need cash flow, like, you know, desperately. And so, I think when you know you are building something in amazing landscapes and you know that St. Andrews, which has always been my exemplar and is my favorite golf course, has stood the test of time and really in the most sustainable way, Tom, by how could you be that intertwined with a community if you weren't sustainable, if you weren't sustainable environmentally, if you didn't care about the community? These are not things we can pick up and leave. And so I think as we go into these communities and we think about building something, you know, that we know can outlive us long after we're gone, you really take the approach that we are the stewards of, you know, of this. And I think, you know, treating every single person, the same way, and whether that's, you know, trying to create, my favorite guest reviews are, you know, when people say it was the greatest day of their life or it was magical. And I think we need to bring that same approach to all of our team members and all of the locations. And I think if we keep choosing places, you know, I'm 44. I say, and I'm not totally joking, that I've got 44 good years left in me of doing this. I think if we keep going to places that, you know, my litmus test is, do I want to come back here every year for the next 44 years of my life? And I think if we choose that and, you know, we treat people well, I think we'll, that'll be success at whenever we hang it up.
Would you like to make any big announcements here, Ben, about, what's in the future for Cabot?
Well, yeah, we've got a couple of big announcements, I think, but I'm going to make you have me back and we'll talk about those. But I think we've got a couple of biggies coming down the pipe, so we'll cross our fingers and not get ahead of ourselves and hope we get those. And I'll give you a call and we can chat about them.
Exciting! We'd love to have you back, Ben. Can't thank you enough for the time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, always, Tom. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And if you enjoyed this episode, we strongly encourage you to become a member of the Golfers Journal. Or if you already are, to share it with your friends. As a reader-supported publication, we couldn't do it without you. We also couldn't do it without the help of our partners, and they are Titleist, Scotty Cameron, FootJoy, Holderness & Bourne, Omega, Charles Schwab, and BMW. We'll see you next time on the Golfers Journal podcast.